Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
The Team Never Quit podcast is sponsored by Navy Federal Credit Union. Navy Federal has multiple savings and investing options to help you get closer to your financial goals. Learn more at NavyFederal.org.
Never quit. Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. Marcus, John, what's up, guys?
You know, ready for another one?
Yes, sir.
All right.
I'm excited, man.
Let's do it.
Hey, we've got somebody cool in virtual land of Zoom hanging out with us today. Chris Bussler, man. What's up? What's going on? Welcome to the show.
This is called Half In, Half Out of the Studio.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm doing well, man. I'm really happy to be here. It's an honor to meet you guys.
Well, brother, man, thanks for being here. Happy New Year. We got 2022 kicking off. I know it's going to be an interesting one for sure. We've been through a lot already.
Absolutely.
That's a wonderful thing about going through a bunch of stuff with each other is that it makes us not only stronger, but it brings us closer together. I know a lot of people don't see that, but those of us in the military, it's kind of that's the life we lead and what we have to go through and what we kind of pull away from that. So thanks again for being here, bro.
Well, before I do a formal intro of Chris, I got to say, we've got a Patreon question that I figured we could talk about. What is the craziest dare you have ever agreed to?
That's a good one. Join the military?
That's pretty crazy.
Wow, I can't think of anything.
That is a tough one.
Yeah.
John, you got anything?
Oh, I just thought of mine. Okay. Go ahead, who's got one? All right, so in sniper school, I got dare. We were at Pendleton and on the stock field, man. They had those old cactus that had the huge leaves on them. I forget what they're called, man. But anyways, I had to cut some of those pads off, put them in my uniform, and do the stalk with that thing with those in my uniform, including down in my drawers, man. And which I thought I was tough, and that would be a great idea. About 4 hours later, I was regretting it, but yeah, that was probably one of the dumbest ones I did.
Golly,
I can't think of anything. Usually people don't dare me anything.
Are they still say that word around here? I haven't heard that in a while.
I dare you. Yeah.
We're bringing it back because there used to be the double dare.
The triple dog dare.
Put your tongue on the flagpole.
Yeah, right? We're bringing those back, man, the dares.
I can't remember either. That's good.
I know when I was a kid, you know, who didn't dare you to jump your bike off of something?
Oh, yeah.
And you had to do it.
Well, that's the first bike wreck, right?
Yeah, exactly.
When you got dared to do that. I got on a hunt, got dared to step out and go slap one of those Cape Buffalo on the ass. I was halfway through it until I started to turn around and come back. But, yeah, the bicycle ones are always, that's how it starts, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's always on the bike. Think you're Evel Knievel.
All right, well, Chris grew up as an Air Force brat in the 1970s and 1980s. He joined the Marine Corps Reserves right out of high school and was assigned to the MP Co-C in Dayton, Ohio as an 0311 rifleman. He is a retired Marine combat veteran and the author of No Tougher Duty, No Greater Honor. Excited to be having you here today, man.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you got to take us way back. Honor. Take us way back.
Yeah, Air Force brat. So you're 70s, 80s, baby. That's good. That's what we are.
That's right. Born in 74.
What's up, right? Yeah. We're a different breed, man. The hybrids, the 70s and 80s. Yep. But you're an Air Force brat. You got military. Is that a history in your family?
Yes, sir. Yeah. My dad served in the Air Force. He was three tours in Vietnam. It was where he met and married my mom when he was stationed in Thailand. I have history where my my grandfather served in the Pacific during World War II. I have a granduncle who landed on Omaha Beach, fought his way to Bastogne before he got hurt and medevaced out. Going back all the way to the Civil War.
That's awesome. It's amazing to have when you, the cool part about this day and age and the technology we have is looking back and finding the history.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes that stuff gets lost even when you have it in your family, the same way with us. It got hurt right before Bastogne. Everyone got hurt. Man, they marched across that hole. That was, and talking to those World War II veterans, there's not very many of them left in the Korea and the Vietnam guys, man, they always kind of give, you know, tell us how great, you know, it's good having us down here and everything like that, man. But what they had to go through was something.
Yep, absolutely. There was no taking some time off and you know, you had to get right back into the middle of the fight.
Wanted to go back up in there, but because we're together so long.
Yep.
I mean, just to jump in on that place is the craziest thing. None of the shells that hit the beach landed where they were supposed to. They dropped them and scattered them all over the world.
Yep.
Had to march their way
the
back.
The bombers came in. They didn't even hit the targets.
Not
they
even one of them. I know. I didn't know that till recently. I was watching something, man. Some of the documentaries they got there, they're like, oh, yeah, the shelling didn't even hit. They dropped them into a live target. And I was like, that's sweet.
Yeah, the first wave. I just finished reading Bedford Boys, who was a bunch of guys from Virginia. It was a National Guard unit that was on that first wave. And I want to say it was like 19 of them in this one little town. I ended up dying.
Yeah.
Company A of that group there.
Right. Yeah. That's probably when they started dividing us up, right? And the brothers, and it was during the World War II boys, because there's so many of them would die from one town.
Sullivan brothers.
Yeah, it would debilitate the entire town. Yeah, Sullivan's on the ship. Yeah. For sure. That was one thing when my brother and I were in, we weren't allowed to ride in the same Humvee or the same helicopter.
Wow.
It was just, people ask if that Sullivan Act is a mandatory thing. Well, it's in the military, we don't ever talk about this, but there's some understood rules that we follow, like some protocols, just because of stuff that happened in the past. And that's kind of one of them.
Yep. Yep. I didn't get the honor of serving with my brothers. My brother broke his hip in boot camp 2 weeks from graduation, and my other brother served in the Air Force, so I didn't get a chance to serve with them.
You were the only Marine?
I am the only Marine in the entire history of my family.
Is that true?
Absolutely.
Oh, that's awesome. The family reunions are great. That's bragging rights right there.
Yeah.
That's bragging rights. Because once a Marine, always a Marine. And if people don't know this, like if you join up and sign up for the military into the Navy, you have to go to Navy boot camp. If you go to Army, you have to go to Army boot camp. Marines have to go to Marine. But if you just lateral over to a different service branch, like from Army to Navy or Navy to Air Force, you have to go back through their boot camps. The only ones that don't are Marines. They're the only ones that don't have to do that. It's pretty amazing. I'll tell you a lot. I give Marines a lot of props now because y'all have to save my ass so many times back in the day. When we were in our skin, you know the deal. We were like, hey, you know, we didn't need y'all's help. We're tougher and all that bullshit. But now, like, oh, yeah, freaking Marines, man. You need them.
Yeah. We were, when I was in Iraq, man, when we heard we had SEALs operating in our area, we're like, well, holy cow, man, this is pretty awesome. We must be high on the totem pole if they, you know, if we get Navy SEALs out in our area.
I remember when we really started working together a lot, like for the sniper missions and the DAs and stuff like that. And the bragging and the machismo and all that stuff was always there, sure. But, man, we were getting in trouble with each other because of how much fun we'd start to have. Like, their discipline, it's not that we have a lack of discipline, I don't think. We'll probably do, you know. just with everything else, man, it was fun. It was some chaos, man. You want to talk about bringing the hammer down? They put the R2 groups together?
Yep.
We made some noise for sure.
Did you know that you were going to go with the Marines basically since you were young? Like,
yeah,
obviously,
how'd you get that? How'd you?
Absolutely not.
Was that the dare?
No, it wasn't a dare. It was that I grew up in the Air Force. You know, I grew up and my dad worked on the flight lines refueling airplanes, or he was manning a desk. And I grew up, you know, when we lived overseas, seeing the Marines PT in the morning. And, you know,
yeah,
and I saw them. Their uniforms are always tight. And
they
know,
do that too.
Immaculate.
They have the best uniforms. That's one of the deals. Yep. Everyone says that. I like when them suckers show up in their chokers, man, that's a big deal.
My during the Gulf War, my mom was adamant that I joined the Air Force, and my dad was kind of pushing me there too. But after watching everything that these guys did in Desert Storm, and then having the recruiter come up and explain things to us, what was happening and everything, it really sold me. So I knew I was wanting to get in, and I wanted to shoot guns and blow things up and do things that I only seen on movies. And I never thought I'd ever have a chance to ever go to war. I just wanted to go out and do cool things.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying that. A lot of guys, because when you're watching the TV and the commercials and stuff like that, and sometimes like back in our day, they did a great job of recruiting us.
Yep.
Because the movies were designed that way too. I mean, we had Arnold Schwarzenegger, Stallone. I mean, our generation, everybody was, and then the war movies, the martial art movies. They did a great job of doing that. And you signed up for that adventure. I was like, hey, man, I want to scuba dive and jump out of airplanes and shoot guns and blow stuff up. And the war thing was always kind of in the back of your head if you had to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I mean, we trained for war the entire time, whether it's on or not. So the life in that in the military is an exciting, it is exciting for sure. Absolutely. It's funny now because I'm out, and after doing some stretches with the Air Force, I tell everyone who asks me, like, hey, I want to be a Navy SEAL. I'm like, go in the Air Force. You should join the Air Force. They got special forces there. They take care of the people. When we showed up on that Air Force base in Qatar that time, and they had the volleyball courts and the Baskin and Robbins, yeah. And, you know, we had been living in a hole for months. And come in, dude, and I'm like, wow. All the hot chicks join the Air Force. It's amazing. It's weird, man.
Yeah, we ended up doing the same thing, too, when after the invasion, they pulled my team out, one of the first teams, because they thought out these other units that were training. They wanted to get them to get some experience. And so we got on the wrong flight, and we ended up in Oman.
Oh, yeah.
And an Air Force base, Seeb Air Base in Oman.
How about that one?
Yeah, absolutely, with the volleyball courts.
Bro, that's what happened to us.
Yeah,
Pizza
Hut and you know,
that freaking Pizza Hut and that with the swimming pool behind it. Do you remember that? I remember walking off and I was like, is there a swimming pool behind that? I mean, we're tattered, beat that. Yeah, dude. Same time. This is the same time frame. I'll never forget that. That's when I started.
Everybody stopped what they were doing and watched us walk by. Now, we were filthy.
Oh, dude.
Our hair was all, you know, I mean, we haven't had a haircut, you know, in like a month.
Yeah.
You know, and razor burns from shaving so we can keep that seal on our gas masks and everything. Yeah, it's a.
God, I forgot about that, man.
Yeah, those guys, it's kind of like, you know, like the record dance that, you know, record at the dance club just skipped and everybody was like, oh, what was going on here? And you know, we walked in and.
Cause the plane would land and taxi right over to it and drop us off right there.
Yep. Yep. It wasn't that far away from the what they call the Pentagon, which is the new no salute area.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that far away.
Yeah, that's because they were in their bikinis and shorts playing volleyball with perfect tans. I remember that. Not shaving, kind of hairs all adrift, freaking long. And them out there having the time of their life. That's awesome. Yep. Good job. Great for them, man. Go ahead. Oh, seriously, man. Great for them. Huh? Like dumbasses that joined the Marine Corps and Navy. All right, so you joined up. Or you got Air Force in your system already.
Yes,
and, sir. And your brother still went. Are you the oldest?
I am the oldest.
Right on. So the idea to be a full-time Marine when that came up, how old were you? Out of high school or college?
Right out of high school. I signed up senior year. At first, I wanted to go active duty, but after thinking, because I grew up traveling and never having a place to call home. And I figured if I ever have kids, I don't really want them to go through the same thing. So, you know, I already traveled around the world, and I really didn't want to go out and see new sites, but I wanted to serve. So there was a reserve unit close to my house that accepted grunts, and that was, you know, MP Company Charlie in Dayton. And little did they tell me when I signed up and got checked into the unit that they were like, oh, we don't do grunt things here. You're going to be part of mortuary affairs. And I'm like, what the hell is that? And so they were
code
like,
for like death dealer or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm like, do I do funeral details? Yeah. You know, what's that? And he goes, no, you're the guys that go out on the front lines and find the guys who get killed. The guys with their helicopters get shot down. You go get them and you recover their remains and you bring them back. So, I was a little, nervous about the whole idea because that's not what I wanted to do. But after a while of being there, and I realized that the guys there in this unit were cool, and I was never going to go to war. So I would never have to do that job. And little did I know, just 10 years later, I ended up getting deployed.
Oh, yeah. Well, that puts you right in there.
Yes, sir.
I don't know why that reminded me of that movie Predator with Schwarzenegger. They were a recovery unit.
Yep.
And the guys had to come in and get us. I mean, they get dropped into the hot spot to get the, pull those bodies back out for sure. One of the first mission I ever did in my SEAL career was a recovery op. There was an F-18 that got shot down by one of our own Patriot missiles back right when the wars first kicked off.
Wow.
Split his plane in half, and it landed in a lake. You could see the tail fin out of the water, and then the nose had gone all the way down. So we had to go in with EOD and bip that, and then found him on the side of the – he was away from – his chute had been deployed, but he didn't make it. And I remember that recovery op. So, we got an idea of what you guys do. So yeah, go ahead.
That was the idea. It started because of back in Vietnam, there was a guy named, I think it was Lance Corporal Jackson from Atlanta, Georgia. He was with 3rd Battalion, 4th Marine, same guys that I was with, but he was with the India Company. And there was an attack and I guess they had all their things from their artillery, all the bags for the shells. The gunpowder bags,
yeah.
They ended up flashing and blowing up. And, those guys ended up getting hurt. And somewhere along the way, he was missing. So that's how we got the thing started. They tasked out Lieutenant Colonel Cassidy and said, hey, build up a unit that, they can go out there and recover. They know what they're looking for, either on the site or if there's a helicopter crash or anything. And so that's how we got started. And when Somalia kicked off, then they really saw the value of what we were.
When did that unit spin up? Was it during the storms or the shields?
During the storm, they ended up spitting up a bunch of guys and they policed up the highway of death and stuff like that. But they weren't really on the front lines. Not like how we were during our invasion in 03, but those guys were more in the rear. They ended up doing that. And then we were training on World War II manuals.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because nobody else had ever written down what it was like to recover guys and what we needed to know. So all through the 90s, we were just training on just like patrolling scenarios.
Right.
And you go up and you secure the perimeter and you do your site sketch, go in and recover the remains and you extract.
I wonder what caused that, because you're right. I mean, it's not that we had to reinvent the wheel, but I remember when we came in the 90s, because we were, the Vietnam guys were real real heavy, because they trained up the storms and the shields, and it was a lot of that patrolling, desert, kind of, or jungle, it all mixed up.
Yep.
But I guess their war was so jungle. I mean, how could they were fighting in there. The tactics and all that stuff, it's kind of hard to teach us that, because a lot of it was chaos.
Yes, sir.
I mean, it was ambush ops most of the time. For them, they were having to do that. So that's why they're so damn tough. Like, if people aren't aware of that, man, most of the time when the Vietnam guys went in for something, they knew they were coming.
Yep.
And they hit them with
they were striking contact. We didn't get caught in contact in Vietnam, something was wrong. Something was about to happen.
Yeah. So with us, I already dropped in. I had a flak jacket on, came off that plane with, old school green one into the desert.
That's how we had.
Right? I had all that high speed tech with that flak jacket. And they dropped our ass in there, man. And we had to—that's why our leadership was good, our chief stuff like that, man. We for the first couple of weeks trying to get that battle rhythm. Most guys, that's when the units get hit first month or so, month and a half, 2 months, then the last 2 months because they're getting a battle rhythm in the beginning, and then they're getting complacent in the end because they want to go home.
Yep. You know, funny thing about that green flak jacket during the invasion, I took a picture of when we crossed into the breach that night. You could see where I have my green flak jacket over my mop suit.
Yeah.
And I had my E-tool right here in the center of my chest. I was thinking if I did get shot in the chest, it might slow down that bullet enough where that flak jacket could stop that round.
Right. That big, has that bib around the top of it, that big green bib. Oh, man, those are great. And absolutely had that damn mop suit. We had, because when the lightning drills would go down, man, we'd have to mop suit up, freaking sleep in that damn thing. You talk about
it. Yeah, sucked.
Oh, man. That's awesome. Good memory. Way to pull that one back. God, keep going, man. So mortuary affair, that's an entire unit in the Corps in itself.
Yeah, we were the only ones in the entire Marine Corps. Just the unit in Dayton, Ohio. There was, I think at the most we had maybe 37 guys.
So is it divided up? There was a Marine that died. Chance was his name.
Is after what the job we do.
That's exactly what I was about to ask you. So it's split. It's kind of like with us. Like you guys got to go in and get it, bring it back, and then you drop it, and then it shifts over to them, right? There's another unit that does right.
During the invasion, we were purely on the front lines. We were there with the grunts.
Right.
During the confusion of the gigantic sandstorm, we actually
got pushed so bad
in front of the grunts. So, but during my third deployment, it was mostly with the guys who had that loss would bring the remains to us. And we would process the remains. So basically going through and annotating all of like their ID cards, their dog tags, you know, laundry markings. You're making like witness statements and you're collecting all this evidence. So Dover would make that final determination that this person is this person. But there were there's multiple times where if the unit was still engaged in combat or the scene was too catastrophic, they would send my team out.
Right.
So we would go out there on the scene. A lot of times this is Ramadi that we were going into and you know, cleaning up Bradley's.
Right. Ramadi was bad. I was there 06, 07. That sandstorm you brought up in 03?
03, 04, 05, and it left in February of 06.
So I ripped in when you were ripping out in 06. I came in right in the cold. I remember that. And then 02, 03, Iraq. That sandstorm. Hey, man.
03, Iraq.
You don't think sand can get everywhere? It can get inside closed canteen bottles.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like baby powder. Literally, you can slide down the dune and wipe your butt with it.
I still have sand, sea bags still have sand in them.
I pulled out a flag the other day to put a new one up on the flagpole, and when I unfolded it, all that sand was in there. That fine powdery dust.
Talcum powder kind of stuff.
When it gets wet and you try to step it, like moon dust, right? Remember, it clumps up like flour.
It turns to concrete.
Bro, it's that sandstorm. I'll never forget that sucker. That was all stop. It like shut. It stopped all of us.
Right, dig in place,
man.
Huh. Yep.
Good times. All right, so when y'all go out and you collect the is that a standing unit or is it only wartime unit?
It was only wartime unit. That's why they decided to give it to the reserves.
That's pretty cool.
Because there's not a need for it during peacetime.
Yeah.
So at the time, we were the only ones in the Marine Corps that did what we did. But, you know, we're still training on World War II manuals and kind of making things up on the fly.
Yeah.
We really didn't know how to employ them during combat. So when we figured out that we were going to move into Iraq, they spun us up to go train some guys down in Marietta, Georgia, and guys in Anticosti Navy Yards in D.C. So two companies before we punched out. And we were one of the first units that got to Camp Coyote. And we're building that place up. So we built a ton of scud bunkers and put up tents. And
so how long's the pump if there's not that many of y'all?
So at the time, our pumps were supposed to be like 7 months, I guess, to 8 months. But there was three companies, and they moved those other two guys in after us. So then they were looking at that we were going to do the initial invasion. And at the time, they were talking about weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
On us and that kind of stuff. And I didn't find out about this until I started writing my book, that the idea was that for us on the first wave, we're not going to make it. And the guys that trained us, that we trained them in D.C. And down in Georgia, that they were going to supposed to come up and clean us up.
Right.
So...
good feeling, right?
Yeah, we were expecting a ton of casualties because we divided up into three teams, and each of the teams had 1,500 remains. Well, we call them remains pouches, but body bags.
Yep. How many on that team?
On my team?
Yeah.
Yeah. At the time, we had 33 plus a couple of extra guys that jumped in there. So maybe about 37.
And y'all break that down into fire teams from there?
So we broke them into squads.
Yep.
And so my team had 11.
Yeah. That's what we run into, 11s. Yep. Bigger platoons be 18 men, but then the reconnaissance recovery units and stuff like that. And then it can go down from 11 too, if we need be. But
oh, yeah.
All right. So when that unit spun up, you guys were the first ones to go. What year was that?
03.
Well, man, that's when everything was kicking off.
Yes, sir.
Where'd you guys go into? Where'd y'all land and push out of?
I'm sorry?
Where were y'all out of?
We were out of, when we first got in there, we were at Camp Iwo Jima over in Camp Coyote. They moved us, when they were grouping us together, we left out of Camp Bougainville.
All right. How long were you in?
I was in for 17 and a half years.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I got medically retired.
Wow. Nice work, man. Thanks for your service.
No, thank you for yours.
All right. Well, you're welcome. I enjoyed every second of it, man. All right, so when you come back and you get out, what then?
What are you talking about, in country?
Yeah.
Or are you talking about...
Yeah, no, in country. We'll get to back home in a minute. But I mean, like, so when you guys rotate out, then what?
So they really didn't know what to do with this. So we did the initial invasion, and we got replaced. Before we got to the goal line, the goal line was Baghdad. They wanted the other guys that we trained to get more experience. They thought the war was going to end within like a couple weeks. So they moved us down to Kuwait, and we just sat there until they figured out that, all right, we need to send these guys home. So I think we left in like July of 03, one of the very first units to get back.
Where had y'all at KMB or Ali Asaleen? Where were y'all at?
We moved in back down to Coyote, to Iwo Jima. From there, I think we moved out of Ali Asaleen.
Yeah.
And then we flew out.
We were at the naval base there, the Kuwaiti naval base, before it was built up. Like, we were still tent city in it and all that. I heard that place changed now, though. I can only imagine what it looks like.
I'm sure.
All right. So go ahead. You guys rotate back in from the field and then back into Kuwait and set up. And then when you come back, where are you stationed at in the States?
We just come back and we deactivate, go back to our reserve unit, and it's basically you go back into drill status.
Yeah.
But when I came back from my first deployment, you went through your leave and then you signed out and then you went back reserve status. But then I went back, I was a mailman. I went to delivering mail, and then a little bit of time passed and they were like, hey, the MPs from the company Charlie, that side is going to leave and we don't need more true affairs anymore, but we don't have enough MPs to do the job. Do you want to go? And I was like, absolutely. I'd much rather go out there and feel like I'm making a difference, than deliver mail. Delivering mail, you just get up in the morning and no matter how hard you work, as soon as you go back in the next day, you got a mountain of mail to deliver. And over in combat, I felt like I was really making a difference between, helping provide security for the Iraqi people, training up the Marines and feel like that I was doing something that meant something.
Yeah, man, being a mailman, getting up every damn day knowing there's a pile of mail, that's doing something. Don't chuck it on that one, bro.
That's
old school. Like, was it rain, sleet, no matter what, this sucker's going through. You talking about like you're an old school mailman with the truck and the bag?
Yep, and walking.
I make sure that I go out there and talk to my mail lady every time I see her.
It's hard work.
Well, man, we were talking about earlier. I saw something on the news up in L.A. that the people are robbing the trains and just pushing the packages out when they come in, and it's just
it's crazy.
It's like there's somebody. Also, mailman protects your mail. I mean, he looks out for that stuff. That's a noble profession. It truly is. So, man, thanks for doing that one too.
Yeah,
you're a mailman. That's great. Yeah. How do you even get into that? First of all, and tell us some cool mailman stuff. I mean, what about the dogs?
Coolest mailman story.
Cool mailman stuff. You get to meet a lot of really great folks, you know.
How could you not? You go to everyone's house. I mean, they delivering your mail.
Absolutely. And you make really great friends with people that you would have never met. You know, I wasn't going to become a mailman at first. I was wanting to take every police test I could. I felt that I was going to gravitate towards that. Being a police officer sounded really cool. But my dad, when he got out of the Air Force, ended up was working for the post office. And he said, hey, come on down here. And they're testing. And I ended up taking the test and did pretty well. And got hired on back in 98. And I thought I was going to be a mailman for the rest of my life, you know. I thought, hey, you know, I got to work with my dad. So we got to eat lunch together all the time. It was really cool. You get to meet a lot of great folks. You know, I've met guys who served on Iwo Jima, guys who served, you know, the Bastogne. I had one guy that I delivered mail to who was at Monte Cassino in Italy. And literally right down the street, I ended up running into a Air Force. He was a general, but during World War II, he bombed Monte Cassino. And it's like, do you know that guy down there with the Purple Heart plates? And he's like, yeah, I see him all the time. Well, he was there. Huh. So I guess they ended up, you know, becoming friends and stuff. But yeah, man, you get to meet all sorts of great people.
All right, so I got a question to ask you. When I see them drive up trucks loaded down with the mail packages, the letters, individual letters with the addresses, some you can read, some you can't. Your first day on the job. You could just do your route and throw the mail in there like it was nothing. I mean, I that seems like that would be hard to me. Like I watched them do the routes, and one of the guys showed up and he was showing me everywhere he had to go and every drop he had to make. And I was, man, that's impressive. I mean, it's a battle rhythm in that too, right?
You know, and the funny thing is that you have to know multiple routes.
Right.
So you don't learn just one route. You learn. For me, I went over and whoever had a day off, and I had to learn their route. And then if they came in on their day off, I had to go somewhere else. So I knew most of the routes and the people who live there and what mail they get and what mail they don't get.
I was about
get.
To say, man, you got to be the best wheelman in the country because you know the area really well. And everybody's man, that's so-and-so. You know, he runs a hot car shop. You know,
where their mailboxes were. Some people had them in the front. Some people had them in the back. Some you had to go inside. Some people you had to go and hand the mail to them because they were too old to make it to the mailbox. Which houses had the dogs that'll attack you? Where do you have to watch the step for the needles? You know, the drug users, they have needles in the grass.
So when you're going through training, what's the protocol? Do you sit down like they used to do us in the military and you got to watch a video on dog attacks?
You know what? I don't remember anything like that.
Any formal training whatsoever, they just said.
Dog spray, and they just like, watch out for the dogs, you know. You'll have guys, if you're covering their routes, they'll have what's called a dog card. So they'll mix in these cards that'll warn you in with the mail. So as soon as you're going through, you get to that address, and you know that they have cards, you know, for that. You're going to have dogs that are aggressive. But a lot of guys don't do that.
So what is it? You as a delivery guy, you show up and then it's already stacked and racked for you and loaded, and you just have to do the route.
Well, there's guys who deliver their routes. A lot of times they would show up in the morning and put up that mail, and you would get that mail and deliver that for them. Or you would come in in the morning and you would put up that mail as if you were that person, and then you go out on the street and carry.
Okay. So it varied. You had to mix it
up. Right. It varied. I enjoyed it. You know, like I said, the best part about delivering mail is working with really great folks and being a part of, just a lot of people depend on it, especially older folks. You know, they like, that's their interaction for with people every day is right. to come in. And so whenever you see like somebody's mail's piling up and, you know, maybe that person had fallen down, and that happened to me once, you know, I noticed, you know, this lady's who was very punctual with her mail wasn't, and she was elderly. So I knocked on her door. She's like, help me. And I went in and I, you know, got her up out of the chair and everything, and or got her up off the floor into her chair.
That's a great point. You don't really think about it like that, but when it comes to the people right. who come to our house and deliver our mail and do everything, they're also, I mean, it is a welfare check. I mean, it's yep. like you get used to seeing people. If they're not there, you understand that, hey, there might be something going on.
You get to know all their rhythms.
Yeah.
And, you know, how cool, you know, just, you know, if somebody's in like, has medical problems and you get to know all that stuff. And you wouldn't really think so just because you spend so much, just a brief moment in time with that person, but you spend the same people every day.
Right. That time builds up.
And you get to know their mail and what their interests are, that kind of stuff.
Sure. If you really take a hard look at it, a lot of people think that they spend a lot of time, or it's like, oh, this is my friend, and this is when I was like, man, but who do you actually spend more time with? I mean, my crew and I were talking about this. I was like, I grew up, and I still have the same crew I ran around with as a kid, and then I have my new one, and I'm like, man, I spend more time with y'all than I do most people ever.
Yep.
And even if it's at work or if it's whatever it is you're doing, man, you're still spending time with them. It's just what y'all are doing together. So enjoy that time together. Get to know each other, and you'll also get to know each other by default. Just by being around each other, you pick up the mannerisms and how everything works.
So that was a good thing about how I, you know, because I worked with my dad, and I got to know him in a totally different light than I knew him as you know, a father and son. We became pretty much best friends. And so I got to know him more of a man to man than, you know, the father than son. So our connection grew much stronger.
I was about to say, what's that like? I never had that. I didn't have that.
Yeah, it was, it just grew much stronger because he was there, especially when I came back home after my tours, and he could see, because we used to ride together to yeah. work, and he could see how much I changed and how things were bought and how I was so much quieter when I came home. But it's easier to confide in somebody that you trust as a friend than it is that somebody, you know, like it's your dad.
You know, so, all right. It's like, yeah. Hell yeah. I wanted to tell you, but you know, I just couldn't cause you're my father. That's tough.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, so, you know, with him and his experiences and during the Vietnam War, was able to kind of point me in the right direction, even though he said, you know, you've seen a hell of a lot more than I ever did. But, you know, if you ever need somebody to talk to, I'm always here.
Oh.
And, you know,
they're good for that. Yeah, my father was good for that. If I ever needed direction, I mean, and I try to teach this to my sons too. I'm like, hey, you know, I'm your father, I'm not your friend, this whole nine yards, but all, you know, if you need something, like some directions, or I needed something, like, man, it would, the whole thing would shift. Be like, oh, here's what I got for you. Here's where you need to do this, that, and the other, man. That's, yeah, for sure. And then they'd immediately switch back over to that. Every time he looked at me, I thought he wanted to kill me. Even when I wasn't doing anything wrong, he's like, I know you're trying to do something wrong. I'm like, no, sir, I promise. Freaking love you, Dad.
You got injured in 2000.
I love you, Dad.
Please. So you got injured in 2004, but immediately volunteered to go right back in. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
How I got injured?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
Both.
okay. Yeah, I was, I ended up volunteering to go over on my second tour, and they stuck me with a mobile training team. We were supposed to train Iraqi policemen in a town called Haditha.
Oh, what a great op that was, right? We're the same thing, shit. Same town, man. By the freaking damn, right?
That's right.
The dam?
And we're at the hydroelectric power dam. So I was with, they married me up with weapons company, 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines. And we were just there to take over from the Army, the 3rd ACR. And we ended up moving in the area, and how they patrolled was usually in vehicles. And when our lieutenant colonel came in, he was like, nope, we're going to be on the ground. We're patrolling on foot. We're going to get in where the people are, and we're going to make friends and weed these Al-Qaeda guys out. And that's what we did. We go in 18-man patrols and move into the city. And one of the first patrols, I think we were there 2 weeks before I got blown up.
What year was that?
04.
Haditha, man. Go ahead.
March 13th of 2004. 10:30 in the morning.
What, foot patrol?
Foot patrol.
What, you stepped on something or somebody else stepped on it?
I didn't know what had happened at the time, but it was a 122 millimeter mortar that was set up at a base of a telephone pole. I was 15 feet away from it, and it picked me up and threw me off the road, destroyed the radio that I was carrying. The thing was, the guys at the end of the patrol said that it was buried too deep because it blew up more than out.
Right.
And if they buried it closer to the surface, I wouldn't be here now. Because that thing's got a kill radius of 120 feet.
Yeah.
So.
Did you lose anything?
I got a chunk of my leg taken off, my calf. It looks like an ice cream scoop out of my leg. Yeah. I still got a
like piece shark
of
bite?
What's that?
So you got a shark bite.
Yep, I got a shark bite. Yep. And it does look like a shark bite. Funny.
That's what we call them, shark bites.
But I also got a piece of shrapnel right next to my femoral artery, my left thigh. And,
nice. Didn't nick it, did it?
No. They decided to leave it in place.
Is it still there?
It's still there.
Yeah, encapsulated. Those are cool x-rays, yep. Right?
Yep. But as far as that, you know, we got lucky. It, you know, like I tell these guys, if it was written in the stars where it had to happen, the best outcome happened. You know, we got wounded. We didn't get killed.
Yeah.
From it. So, you know, I had another guy that got the shark bite on his tricep. One of our another guy had a piece of shrapnel went through his nose and lodged in his skull. And our corpsman ended up looked like he took shotgun blasts of the back of each leg and the back of his butt and back of his arms.
One of the coolest ones I saw was one of our officers. He got shot in the chest, through but behind it was weird. It was behind his plates, but in front of his ribs. So through the foot, he had a big barrel chest. So it went in one side, yep. Came out in the middle, went to the other middle, and came out the other side.
Wow!
Oh, so cool! And then it had the ripples, the indention ripples. So like when he flexes now, it looks like he's mad ripped.
Whoa!
I know, so cool. So like that was in the morning. This dude's his nickname is God of War, Father of War. I can't remember it now. But anyways, as they were rolling back out, he was running out of the hospital with just the bandage of his body armor in his hand. Wait! I mean, after a while, you send us in there so long, we kind of become what we are. I remember when guys would get hurt in the beginning, they would have 40, 50, 70, 80 surgeries to keep a leg. Now the guys will get a splinter or something like that, and they're like, take it. That pneumatic freaking thing, makes me run faster. And I mean, the technology, I got handed to the civilian guys too, keeping up with us. It's almost as far as we got pushed backwards into going into war is going backwards. You know what I mean? It just is. It's going back to the old school ways when we're killing each other. But the good part about it was our civilian populace saw that, and they started pushing forward in the other direction to accommodate our injuries when we got back. And, you know, bless them for that.
Yep.
Lesson for that.
Absolutely.
All right, man. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's all right. No
that
worries, freaking
Haditha,
man.
That dam op. I'll never forget. We had to stay at the bottom, and the flights of stairs in between the flights of stairs were like there's 20 of them. Oh, so that was the running joke. I'll never forget. We had Hotmail. We got a computer for the first time, and I tried to download one email, and I started it that night. We went on an op, came back, went to bed, woke up next morning. It was halfway down the page. It was down. It was just a picture.
Yeah.
And then they had that five.
We were
that was
on the third.
Go ahead.
We were on the third deck. So everybody used to go down to use the porta johns.
Right.
I decided to go up because nobody wanted to climb all those steps to get to the, and they were the cleanest ones.
So they had the numbers spray painted on the side of the wall as you were going up the deal.
Yep.
That was the cleanest water I'd ever seen. And we were looking for WMD in the bottom. So we were in our mop suits and the Zodiacs with the toad rays out there and streaming that lake. And it was so, because they said they had contaminated the lake. So we were in our mop suits driving around doing that. I'll never forget this. It was so freaking hot. It was like 120 degrees. I look over and our chief's at the bottom of the dam by the spill on that little ledge right there, strips off butt naked and jumps in the lake. He's like, it's so damn hot. I don't care. Hey, that's how we figured out it wasn't contaminated.
We're good.
He didn't even care. He's like, this guy's hardcore.
This heat's gonna kill me before the chemicals.
And as soon as we saw him jump in, we were like, let's go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh yeah, I remember that place. And Hit, did y'all run into Hit? Did you go through Hit?
I don't remember Hit.
The only reason I remember is because we got Hit there.
Yeah. I don't remember Hit, but you know, that's one of those towns that are in that local area there.
Yeah,
so
right around there, for sure.
If we did go through there, nothing really
it's
stuck
small.
With
yeah,
me.
It was small. The only reason I remember it is because of that name. And it was the first time I'd ever see gunfire and missiles going, like, for real. You see them streaming through the air. That was one thing out there is whether you were in it or you weren't, you could still see it all. It was all around you.
Where were you? When were you over at the Haditha?
Man, midsummer 03. Yeah.
Okay. You were right there before me. Were those big high electrical towers, were they still on the ground, or were they on the ground yet, or?
I don't remember those.
Okay. Cause when we rolled up, we were driving because we drove up from Kuwait.
We drove up too.
All the way. We had to drive all that, the gauntlet.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing the big high tension power lines that they had the explosives put at the bottom of them and they had crunched over.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I didn't see that. I remember going out there. Our chief was like, hey, we're probably going to get shot at. Just remember that. I was like, how do you know when we're supposed to engage back? He's like, if your body armor's missing, shoot back. I mean, we were in this huge deuce and a half. And my old boy, one of the snipers, he was sitting on shotgun, you know, on that hump right there, that shotgun seat.
Yep.
I was having the best time. What are we, 23 years old back in them days, man? Just in a foreign, driving back in time, seeing all that. It was terrifying. At the same time, though, for sure.
Yeah.
That's what's so cool about having the old timers around. It's like, man, they just look so comfortable. He's like, this stuff's going to stick to you like a snotty booger. And he's like, he started going on. He's like, I don't give a shit what happens out here. Damn it, we're going to get it done. And then, you know, you're like, yeah, hell yeah, we're going to get it done.
Yeah.
That was a good times, man.
Man.
All right, go ahead. So, Marine to mailman. Were you a mailman before Marine?
No, I joined the Marines right out of high school.
All right.
And,
Marine, mailman, mortuary
guy.
You got the M's down, bro.
Yep, the mailman, mortuary affairs, Marine Corps, married.
MP. Married.
Man. Mortuary affairs, that's got to be
from the Midwest.
Yeah.
Yep, Midwest.
That's a heavy job, man. How do you prepare for something like that? How do you handle that coming back?
See, that's the tough part. You know, I used to think that the actual job of doing it at the time, and it was heavy at the time. You know, my third deployment, we were super, super, super busy. And we had to process some of the guys that some of our friends that got killed, guys that who served in EOD. And so it was terribly rough to do at the time. But when you get home, that's when everything unloads in your mind. And I had a really, really hard time dealing with the aftermath.
Well, it's different because when we're in, like, we never anticipate death. I remember when guys started dying for the first time, it's just kind of like, normally it's not around us, right? You just keep pushing. And then eventually it made it way over to us when everyone kind of started dying. And you get into that zone because y'all had, that was your job. Most of us fight to avoid that. Y'all had to fight to go get into it. Did you ever lose anybody on your team?
No. Just lost some friends that we served with.
Sure. No, I didn't mean friends overall, so everyone's clear about that. But when he talks about we know everybody, it's like, because you start boot camp when we're kids and you just keep going. Like, you're running to guys at schools and lateral over, and then, you know, it'll go years by, and then you're like, hey, who's so-and-so? And then when you get over, you run into guys. That was kind of crazy when they sent us over to the sandbox and you start running into your buddies. I mean, out in the middle of nowhere. In the middle of nowhere, you run into, like, a buddy.
Yeah.
We start recognizing guys that we were on the same convoys during the push during the invasion of Iraq. For instance, this is after I got blown up, but my gunny, they had some guys that came over and they were like, you look familiar. Where are you from? And they were trying to go through their list of where they served at and all this stuff. And they were like, did you lose anybody last year? It's like, yeah, we lost the gunny last year and we gave him the mortuary affairs. He goes, I'm mortuary affairs. So they recognize each other from year before that they had lost the gunnery sergeant. I think he got shot in the neck. But they had to sit on his remains a couple of days before a helicopter could come down and take him. But they recognized him from that.
Yeah. Well, in case people aren't aware of that, usually to get in to get a body, we have to sit. That same thing happened to us. The guys were on the mountain. Side of it.
Yep.
And PJs and everybody had to go in there. The PJs got me out, and then the guys had to go back in. It's something. I mean, it's a good feeling to know that they'll come get you. Like, our guys, we'll come get you.
Absolutely.
I know there's some times out there I was like, man, you guys aren't getting out here fast enough.
No.
You know what I mean? But then on the way back, they were like, we let you sit out here for a couple extra days just to make you nervous. I was like, that's not funny. It's funny now, but you know what I mean? It just, if you guys, for the young guys out there, and you hear these stories, and they're crazy, and they are great, it's an adventure. If you're going to have to live a life down here, you might want to, you can live it any way you want. You can live it like we did. But if you're young and coming up and you're looking for a place and a path to do it, the one that we walk, there's nothing wrong with that. And it does make you different. Hard times do that. But it's not in a bad way, it's in a good way. You don't get battle weakened, you get battle hardened. And as you go through that flow, it ebbs and flows. And there's just times when the ups and downs, but ultimately at the end of it, it creates something that's stronger than anything that went in there, for sure.
Absolutely. You know, and I appreciate even the smallest things to this day. You know, I think that it made me a better person to go through all of that, because to me, family was always big, but now my family is everything to me. And, you know, I've lived so many years away from them, and I try to spend as much time to be there as a good father, you know, as a good role model, you know. You know, I appreciate the smallest things like air conditioning.
Oh, it's so good. I was doing that the other day, bro.
Refrigeration.
Hot water, air conditioning.
Yeah, hot water.
Yoga pants.
Like toilet paper.
The wheel. Maybe toilet paper is a good one.
You know.
There's some blessings down. Yeah, hot water and cold air.
Even food, eating food with no sand in it.
Yeah, not out of a green Marmite tub.
Yep. You
know, what are we having for dinner?
Small
Something
things.
Out of a green Marmite tub. Why?
You know, being able to go to sleep at night and not have to, that sitting in the back of your brain that you may not make it tomorrow.
Now, that insanity would go until it would leave. That's when when I think that we had to shift gears is when it was like, oh, you know, whatever.
Yep.
Sit here and thinking about it, or I'm not thinking about it, and then when it happens, it just it goes down.
No, that was my job, you know. That's what really made it tough is when I got blown up on my second tour, and then going back for my third, my invincibility bubble got popped.
Oh.
So now I'm in a job that I know exactly what I'm going to look like when, you know, this vehicle blows up. Because, you know, they would set up a scene, they would blow up a Bradley, and then they would try to draw more guys in.
Yeah.
And that was us. We usually rolled out with EOD because they gotta clear a lane for us so we can get to the remains. And they got to check the remains to make sure that, you know, there's no 40 mic that's sitting, you know, sitting inside this inferno overnight ready to blow. So we've got to, you know, work with those guys. And those guys all had bounties on their heads.
Yeah. What was the separation in time from when you got hurt till you went back?
I got blown up in March of 2003, and I was spinning back up in, I want to say, May of 05. I mean, 05. Yeah, it was 05. No, not 03. March of 04, then May of 05, I'm spinning back up to go over.
Yeah. My turnaround was like that too. I remember getting back in there. I kind of had the heebie-jeebies. First gunfight we got in, I remember we got back to the base, and one of my new guys came up to me. He's like, man, I was nervous. He's like, I looked up there, and you just kind of took a knee, and you looked around for a little bit, and you made the call and got us out of there. I just wanted to say thanks for coming back in here. I was like, keep thinking that. I was like, I was nervous as hell. I was like, when those bullets started flying, and I took that knee out, first thing in my head, I was like, what in the hell am I doing back in here? I'm not kidding. And it seemed like it lasted forever. And then finally, I was like, all right, let's get out of here kind of deal, and we fought our way out of there. But it knocked the courage out of me. Like, I got my courage whipped out of me, and I had to go get that back. Like, I had all these tools and this fancy race car that could do all kinds of cool stuff, but I didn't have a driver to drive it. I left that dude on the mountain, so I had to go get build a new one. And it started by getting back into the war all the way up until today, kind of every day.
Yeah, it was everything in my body was telling me that I wasn't going to make it, you know, that this is the mission. And, but I wanted to be there for my troops. I wanted to be there with them. And so, you know, I just had to suck it up and push through it and just hope for the best.
Oh yeah.
You know, by the time it got to getting on the bird, leaving for my third deployment, I was surprised I was walking onto the bird.
Yeah. All right. So tell me about the book.
All right. When I first came back home, I had a really rough time adjusting, and I lost my job. I ended up leaving the post office. I couldn't handle the stress. I was basically drinking every night so I can sleep. And I ended up going to the VA and going through a lot of mental therapy and stuff. And years go by, I ended up going to the VFW, and I started to talk to one of the Navy corpsmen from Vietnam, and he was like, I know what you need. And I'm like, yeah, what, another beer? And he was like, no, you need to sit down and start writing, because it helped me out when I came back home from Vietnam, and I'm pretty sure it will help you out. So at first I thought it was a bunch of BS. So I ended up just tucking away in my back pocket. And just one night, I woke up from another nightmare. And instead of grabbing another bottle to go back to sleep, I just pulled out the computer and I just started writing. And I ended up writing like 20 pages that night. It just felt good to get something out and to go through and put it somewhere and not really go through and feel like I'm being judged for whatever my decisions were and everything with these past events that had happened. So I just ended up keeping it up. And over the years, I ended up teaching myself how to write, and I ended up writing from different perspectives and stuff. And I would take those stories and go into the VA with my therapist, and we would go through my sticking points and talk about them. He'd help me work through those. And it ended up really helping my marriage out, because my wife was able to read like the day one of my buddies got blown up, and we had to process him and all the feelings that went up. And so she was able to understand a lot better than what it was before, you know, where I tell her and she didn't get it. Yeah. But when she read the book or read the chapters, she was able to understand where my mind was at. So a couple of years go by, and I ended up writing a bunch of stories. My wife's like, "Hey, you ever thought about writing a book? You know, putting all this stuff down, this stuff's pretty good." And so I ended up saying, "All right, let's go ahead and do that." And writing the book helped me get it out and then put my hands around it, you know, to get it out. And it ended up being something that, instead of me being ashamed of all those times I felt weak, it ended up making me feel a lot better that I can put it somewhere. So I ended up publishing it, and it has, I'm getting messages from people from all over the world thanking me for the job. First off, it's one of two books ever written about the subject. But the way that I explain everything in the book is I go through and admit my failures, and I admit my emotions, and the good times and the bad. So it's really helped me out considerably.
Man, that's called flipping the script.
Yeah.
I write too. I keep a journal.
Yeah.
And I just kind of started writing with notes, just like little stuff. People are like, how do you write all that? I'm like, man, just put that sucker by your toilet and just jot something down at the end of the day, whenever, you know, whenever you're sitting in there. And it's almost like this. So when you're holding on to that into your head, it's like a movie director holding on to a script that he's trying to get out. Only we had to go through it in real life. So when you're putting it on paper, it's legit. It's not something you're having to come up to, because the emotions are what's pushing that. And then when you write it down and you read it back to yourself, you're reading a script that you wrote, that you lived through yourself, and it takes pressure off of you. I mean, it really does. Not only that, when you slide that over and people read it, it's like watching a movie. It's like you telling them a story. And not only that, you become a character in it, and your friends change their lives, just like you said. And it does. It helps, because if you keep it in your head and it keeps rolling around, like if you have a constant thought that keeps rolling around, either say it out loud or write it down, and that'll help that go away.
Right.
Otherwise, you'll just keep it bottled up in there. It's a real thing.
It goes in circles, because you're reliving that moment over and over and over in your head. And no matter how strong you are internally, if that cycle keeps on going, you don't put an end to that cycle, it'll wear you down.
Yeah.
I say that even the mightiest of mountains will eventually tumble into the sea. You know, you let those waves hit you every day, it'll eventually derail you and knock you down. And that's what helped me, was to be able to stop that and to, you know, just to get it out.
Yeah.
And able to get some sleep without turning into something that, like alcohol that I was drinking every night, you know, and going through that whole phase.
Now, people sleep a lot better after something than when they watch something, as opposed to when they go through it personally. It's kind of one of those deals where, like, oh, I saw that on a TV show. People saw and watched what happened to us, it's entertaining to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know that, because when they make movies into it, they go get entertained by it.
Yeah.
And that, in any capacity, releasing that to everybody else, like giving that problem to everybody else, and they help you with it. The best part about what happened to me is when we start talking about it. Because the people are like, "Hey, man, good job." I'm like, "Really?" I'm like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Thank you." Just the first one, it's kind of like chipping all that away. That's what our countrymen are for. People are there's one big family down here. And every now and again, somebody will come up and throw one of those at you, like, thank you for doing that. And it pulls off a piece of that pain.
You know, like they say, it takes a village to raise a child. I think it takes, you know, a village to welcome back the warriors.
Yeah, heal a warrior. Sure. Absolutely. They're the ones that send us.
Yep.
If it takes a village to send the warriors out, it takes a village to bring them back.
Right. You know, and, you know, one thing that I found out that it also helped out a lot of other people who served over there, and they thanked me. Like some of the guys who served with Master Sergeant Angus and Staff Sergeant Richardson, when those guys had got killed, the guys from their team has reached out and thanked me for bringing them up and trying to honor them. And also the book reminds people that the guys who got killed on the battlefield is just the beginning of the sacrifice.
Yeah.
It's the their family members that still have to make that sacrifice every day. And that I acknowledge that at the end of the book.
Well, it shows you that we're still that there are Americans that are still willing to sacrifice for their country.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I also wanted to make sure that, you know, remind people that these guys, they go over, they're not just numbers on a whiteboard somewhere. These are real people with real aspirations.
Yeah.
And, you know, real families, and they go over, and not just once, but, you know, 2, 3, 4 or more times.
Sure. Think about that. That's not the chumps that sign up for the military to go into war.
Right.
That's your best. That's the best guys you got. They're the ones that will get in there and willing to do anything.
You know, they're putting their families on hold. They're putting everything on hold to go over and to do a job that the American people asked them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that's, you know, that's sacrifice.
Oh yeah, that's love too.
Yep,
for sure.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, what? How can people find you and get to you? And we'll promote your book, man, and push you out as
absolutely
best we can.
Thanks,
welcome to the team. I got a file on you right here, bro. So
awesome.
Ain't going anywhere.
Yeah, the book is called No Tougher Duty, No Greater Honor, a memoir of a mortuary affairs Marine, and that is on Amazon, Kindle, and on Audible. And you can find me on Facebook at No Tougher Duty, No Greater Honor, or on Instagram is at @no_tougher_duty.
All right. So what about the future? You podcasting? You putting your word out? What are you doing? You delivering flyers? You have a souped-up metal truck with a high-powered engine in it?
I don't know, man. I went to lineman school, electrical lineman.
Yeah.
And I ended up graduating from there, and I ended up just taking tests and seeing where I can get plugged in at. I've got a few more book ideas because I really enjoy the process of writing.
It's changed so much. The whole writing concept and how people read and gather their information.
Yeah.
It's really something. Plus, all the information is out there. I mean, anytime you post something or print something out from your perspective, I mean, death, right? Let's be the death messenger. When death went down, you got to show up.
Exactly.
I mean, I can only imagine the call signs and nicknames they got for your crew. I'm sure there's a bunch of them. Just off the top of my head, what I was thinking when you told me what you did, I was like, oh, freaking.
We used to roll out, our call sign was Crypt Keeper.
Yeah, I knew. Yeah, oh yeah. Yep. You go all day with them.
Yep.
I bet. Hey, your badges should have been that Crypt Keeper because they think that Joker's bad. The old school Crypt Keeper from back in the day.
That's right.
Here comes the Keepers. All right, yeah. Just keep doing what you're doing, man. I mean, married, kids?
Yep, I'm married. Same woman. For the last 100 years.
I'm nice work. No, it's good job. Yeah. I've been running through time
with
mine,
too. We've been together
too.
For 23 now. We have two beautiful girls. One's 21. The other one is about to turn 11 here soon. And
so you're about to go through the teenage years. I have one who's nine. Wow. She's about to be 10. So I'll be going through that with you.
Yeah. Our older one, she's, she's 21. And that is rough. Going through seeing the changes and stuff, Now this other one is my little sweetheart, and she, you know, follows me around, and we'll work out in the garden together, or, you know, and so she's always wanting to know what's on my mind, and to watch her do her changes here soon. It's bittersweet, man.
Sure. I make an arrangement with Adelaide. Like, all right, look, I'm going to take care of you and make sure you get to where you're going. When I get old, you got to take care of me. You can go do anything you want, but then it's got to be a doctor so you can take care of Dad. Deal? Don't worry about how mean I am and disciplining your brother. All right, he's man cub. That's different. My daughter, like, sweetheart, yeah. Because I think your mom might let me die.
That's funny.
Oh, man.
Chris, thanks so much, man, for coming on.
Hey, it's an honor, man. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, man.
Take care of yourself. God bless you, man.
Oh, God bless, brother. Take care.
Yep, out.